Have Muslim women gone from being victims of pity to objects of suspicion? And do they need rescuing by Western feminists? Dr. Shakira Hussain of the National Center for Excellence in Islamic Studies is the author of the new book, From Victims to Suspects, Muslim Women Since 9/11.
Not all Muslim women regard themselves as suffering from oppression, and most of those who do, they don't want to be ignored, but they also don't want to be treated as though they're just passive victims. To say that Muslim women aren't just passive victims isn't to say that there aren't sources of oppression that they're being subjected to.
Now, one group, of course, that your book does deal with very specifically, which I think you do say requires Muslim women needing rescue, and that is surely the young women who are being lured to the so-called caliphate of the Islamic State group in Syria and Iraq, 500 from Western countries, 40 from Australia. Why do they need, as you argue, rescuing in some sense?
We have to be very careful in the way that we frame our response to young women and young men, for that matter, who are joining the Islamic State. Because for many of them, it's an expression of independence and of adulthood. If we treat them as children, that just reinforces their sense of needing to get away. So to just treat them simply as though we need to whisk them up and baby them really plays into the hands of the people who are telling them they're old enough to leave their families, they're old enough to join this new utopia, they're old enough to dedicate their lives for a cause that's more important than whatever they've been up to in Australia or the United Kingdom or Germany or wherever. They're old enough to die for a cause. And they're also motivated by injustices that they see being inflicted on their co-religionists in various parts of the world. Their response to that injustice is immensely misguided, and it has the effect of inflicting injustice upon other people, most notably, of course, upon other women and girls who are being persecuted by the so-called Islamic State.
But clearly, there is this difficulty in how you deal with these young women in particular, because you say they are children. And in the case, for example, of Tara Nettleton, her daughter, 13 years old, married off, then bearing a child of a terrorist fighter. I mean, that is a sexual servitude, and you highlight that in your work.
Oh, yes, definitely. And these children have reached the location that they're in through various routes. In the case of Tara Nettleton's children, they were taken there by their parents, whereas some of the young women from the United Kingdom, in particular from Germany, did leave without their parents' consent. And their narrative reminds me of many of the stories that we've read over the years that Australian writer Hanifa Dean calls the harem horror stories of these young women who are brought up by these repressive Muslim parents and refuse to be allowed to make their own choices, who have to run away and claim their independence. It sounds very like that. They hid. They didn't tell their parents what they were up to. They made preparations. They packed their suitcases. They led their parents to believe that they were staying at a friend's place, but no, they were already on their way out of the country. The only difference is that the destination is not some women's refuge where they take shelter and then go on to university and to building an independent life in the UK. Their destination is the so-called Islamic State in Syria.
Now, interestingly, Shakira, in your book, you argue that there are, in fact, strong matriarchal elements in Muslim societies, you know, where mothers do have extraordinary influence. Why do you seem, however, at times to be ambivalent about mothers exercising that? You shy away a little bit from the demand, as it were, that mothers should be stopping their children, especially their sons, from getting involved in extremism.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, there is finally this recognition that women can occupy a very important position as the heads of households, but then you're then held responsible for anything that may go wrong within that family. It's your fault. And your responsibility as the head of that family is to make sure that nobody breaks the rules and that everybody is completely loyal to the needs of the wider society. There's an expectation that you will be hyper-monitoring your kids at all times, that you'll engage in basically surveillance of your own kids. Now, that undermines your offspring's trust in you, really, if you're supposed to be like the government's spy. This talk about how parents should be monitoring their kids' internet usage. So it's not just that you've got to be worrying who they're associating with outside the house, you've got to be worried about what's going on in their bedrooms.
But that's
all parents do, sorry.
Yeah, but Shakira, that's not just a demand made of Muslim parents. I think that's an expectation of most parents, that they'll monitor what their kids are doing online.
Oh, yes, and it's a fear that most parents have too. Cyberspace is not something that previous generations of parents have had to deal with. But I think that putting your kids on a tight leash in cyberspace as well as in physical space is enormously counterproductive. It's good for you to be aware that there are hazards in their own bedrooms, on their own computers, on their own phones, but you absolutely can't be watching everything they do all the time.
You refer to something called patriarchal bargaining that goes on by Muslim women. What is patriarchal bargaining?
Well, this is a term used by Denise Candiotti back in the 80s, I think even, to refer to the way that women negotiate their position within patriarchal societies. And because women occupy varying level of status within that patriarchy, and you achieve more status by conforming to the rules yourself and also by ensuring that lower ranking women, and that's usually young women, conform to the rules as well. First of all, by teaching them what the rules are and why they should be regarded as important, and then by punishing them just in terms of ostracization, in terms of looking down on them, in terms of exclusion and gossip, if they don't uphold those norms themselves.
But you acknowledge that this patriarchal bargaining is within, as you say, certain parameters. Should those parameters migrate to Western societies as well?
Well, we have parameters in Western societies too, but they're so taken for granted that we don't generally recognise them, whether it's in terms of sexual norms or in terms of career expectations. It's hard for women who've been brought up to follow a certain role and certain norms, then to find that suddenly once they reach a certain point, actually being a fabulous wife and mother isn't good enough. You didn't have a degree, you didn't achieve in the workplace. And for women younger than you, that means you're basically irrelevant. Your opinion is not really worth listening to because you stuck to what you were told at the time was the appropriate role for you. That's now out of date, but nobody's going to let you go back and do it again and do it differently.
I guess, though, this is, you know, one of the big questions raised in your book, that what happens when the claims of minority groups clash with, you know, the laws and the mores of you know, a different set of values of gender, you know, of ostensible gender equality. That's really one of the tensions and struggles in your book, isn't it?
Yes, and it's one that feminism was wrestling with well before 9/11. And there were very heated debates over whether multiculturalism was bad for women, because multiculturalism values cultural diversity. Multiculturalism says that minority communities should be allowed to maintain their own norms, their own boundaries, whereas surely gender equality requires that at least some of these norms should be abandoned, and those around women's sexuality in particular.
Where do you fall on that?
I don't think that the norms of migrant communities can or should or do stay in stasis after the process of migration and settlement. Of course they're going to change, but I don't think that it's appropriate for others to go in and attempt to impose change. I think it arises naturally from within.
Shakira Hussain, author of From Victims to Suspects, Muslim Women Since 9/11, ending this week's Religion and Ethics Report. And at our website, you can download and share our stories. Thanks to producer Nadiet El-Ghorli and technical producer Tim Jenkins. I'm Andrew West. Back next week.